Welcome to the first class on the ships of Tarshish. I want to start the class by asking a question. It's not one that I require your response, but I want you to think about it for a moment. And I want to ask you, what's in a name? Now, many of you probably thought of this on your own, or you've used it or acted upon it as parents from time to time. But what is in a name? Well, a lot. A great deal, as a matter of fact. For example, a lot of times people identify your name with certain things. If you had the name Rockefeller at the end, they probably think of a house up on the hill that had about 40 rooms in it, a pool, possibly even about 10 cars, garage. And everybody would think of you in terms of wealth. You'd have the best of clothes, the best of education, the best of everything, from food on. Now, that same situation might be totally different if you were in the early 1800s and you were observing as thousands of new Irish immigrants just come into your country. And someone says, you know this Joe Garrity? And you think, Irishman. Oh, man. Irishman. Drop it at a hat. They'll fight at the drop of a hat. Oftentimes, people would think of them in terms of brawling, drinking. All of those things might come into your mind at that time, because of all the problems and situations they had in, say, towns like Boston, Massachusetts, trying to accommodate so many different peoples, and all the problems that go with bringing in all these kinds of immigrants happen that way. So you might think of that name and think of something totally different. If you were a parent, and I was a teenager, and I came home late at night, and in the early morning, my father comes over and grabs me out of bed and says, "Get in here." I think I'd know right away that I was in trouble. And I go into the living room, and there's the whole family sitting there looking at me. And he said, "You remember what happened last night?" And everything's kind of foggy. "Well," he said, "let me read it to you from the Herald Tribune." And he opens up the Tribune, and he begins to read how seven young men rampaged through the waterfront that night, causing all kinds of disturbances, right? They were connected with damage to furniture, damage to vehicles. There was fights and brawls, and there was liquor involved. All of those things could have been associated in that article. And then, for the real important detail, he reads out the seven names, and you're one of them. And he begins a 20-minute tirade, and he ends by saying these important words. "Do you realize what you have done? Do you realize what you have done to this name of ours?" Right? "You have changed it. You have altered it. From now on, everybody who thinks of the Harrison name will think of this person who is irresponsible, of all family members who are irresponsible, they're neglective of other people's feelings and desires, they cause trouble and damage wherever they go. That'll be the image that you have just created for our name." And it's true. Dramatic things can alter a name. Most of the time, we're fairly neutral on a name. We don't know anything about it. But dramatic things can alter a name. Like Rockefeller, we automatically think of Standard Oil and money and wealth. Or of a man like, say, Joe Garrity, who might be like this teenager who gets in brawls and fights and everything. As soon as a name is mentioned, people get a mental image, right? The name changes, literally, changes an individual. Well, when we start out looking at the ships of Tarshish, we start with a name, an individual, right? Let's look at Genesis 10, verses 4 and 5. Matthew, would you? Genesis 10, It says, and the sons of Javan, Elisha and Tarshish, Kittim and Dodanim, by these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, everyone after his tongue, after their families, in their nations. It's the first time in the Bible that we see the name of Tarshish. And when you look at it, he's just simply in the middle there, one of the sons of Javan. Now, the Bible doesn't just throw names out because it wants to give us names, right? There's always an important lesson involved with it. And in this case, there's an important lesson. And we get it from the word divided. There's something happening here. This is right after Japheth, Shem, and Ham have gotten off the ark. Time has gone by. And instead of men going out and doing what God had asked Noah, that is to be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth, instead, what did they do? What did they do? Well, they formed up in a very small congregation of people, and they picked a leader based on, well, they thought was a great thing. He was a hunter. And they started to build a great tower, right? And eventually, God comes down, he sees this great tower, and he says, this isn't what I'm about. First of all, the tower was designed so that if there was ever a flood again, or perhaps any other great tragedy, they could run into the tower and be safe. That's not what God wanted them to do. He said, be fruitful, multiply, and replenish the earth. And they weren't doing it. And so what did God do? He changed their tongues. And so right now, at this point in time, these men are looking for a place to go because they speak a language that they understand, and the whole earth is before them. Imagine the choice of what you would have. The whole earth is before you, and we have an idea of what is important to them by the word Isles of the Gentiles. Well, they could have picked, for example, the steppes of Russia, right? Or they could have picked the Rocky Mountains. Or they could have picked perhaps some swampland. But they chose to pick the Isles of the Gentiles. Now, when you see isles, the first thing you're going to think of is islands. That is a piece of land surrounded by water. But actually, the Roman historian by the name of Jasenius tells us that isles do not necessarily refer to islands per se. It's a common misconception. All that means is that you have a long coastline, that you're not landlocked per se, like Afghanistan. So these were people that wanted to go to a place where the water touched the land. That was their vision. That was their vision of happiness. Why? Why did he want that kind of situation? Why not something else? Well, obviously he had a vision of his own. And I believe in those long extended coastlines, he saw many generations of opportunity in travel, fishing, trading, shipbuilding, warehousing, and perhaps exploring, to name a few. Because it all goes with water, doesn't it? And with land. Now, the sea has always been what I call a dangerous place to make one's living, but never so much as it was at the dawn of mankind. It's really a paradox when you think about it. On the one hand are deep-rooted dangers fundamental to large amounts of water. And on the other, there is this overwhelming sense of excitement and exhilaration. You know, we sometimes see that with our children. I remember used to take my kids to the beach. Sometimes you have a long drive. And during that period of time, my daughter used to say, are we there yet? You know what I mean? And over the same sentence. But when we pulled into the beach and you could see the sand and the water and everything, it was just like a different person came to life. There was excitement. And that has been something that man has always had when it comes to water. The sense of excitement. The sense of the unknown, the challenge. It's just there when you get to the water. And
It's a strange thing, but it has existed from time immemorial. Herman Melville captured this spirit in his book called Moby Dick, The Story of the White Whale. You recall in his main character was a man by the name of Ishmael, and he begins the whole story by giving this little segment of speech where he says, "Some time ago, having little or no money, I decided to see the oceans of the world. Whenever I get grim and spleenful, whenever I feel like knocking people's hats off in the street, whenever it's a damp, drizzly November in my soul, then I know it's high time to get to sea again. Choose any path you please, but 10 to 1 that carries you down to water. There's a magic in water that draws all men away from the land, leads them over the hills, down creeks and streams and rivers to the sea. The sea where each man, as in a mirror, finds himself." Yes, a place to find oneself. Perhaps that's the answer to this somewhat paradox. Where else but on the deck of a ship could be found something as gentle as a cradle rocking a 1 hour, but a howling banshee the next? Where else but on the deck of a ship could a man travel 100 or more miles in a single day, when most landlubbers in that time never traveled more than 50 their entire lifetime? Where else but on the deck and rigging of a ship could one get lost in the multicolored hues of a sunrise or the storm-filled heavens at sunset? You know, Christopher Columbus saw this, and he warned his men about this too. He said, "Shipmates, shipmates, bestir yourselves. Beware when you are up and about, for surely the sea will find you out." It was a warning. Yes, Columbus knew that one thoughtless moment in the masthead, one careless movement on a bowsprit, or one haphazardly tied halyard, and a man could be sent post-haste to a watery grave. In due course, men would come to discover the compass for obtaining true north. They would come to appreciate what made for the best designs in a ship's construction, and they would become further skilled in fabricating better rudders and various shaped sails for steering and for harnessing the wind. However, the science of navigation and the ability to forecast the weather, all which weighed heavily on a man's personal safety, would have to wait for mathematics and knowledge to increase. Notwithstanding, there was this rare breed of sailor that defied danger, disregarded personal safety, and substituted instinct and courage for fear and terror of the unknown. That sailor started with one man whose name was Tarshish. Over time, it extended itself to include his family and then to be represented by succeeding generations of Phoenician sailors. Now, if you turn to Psalms 49, verse 11, you'll find there that the scriptures reveal that as the people of the world began to migrate to various places, they called their lands after their names. And that makes sense, right? We see that today. People are proud, and so they called their lands by their names. And it's a further evolution, isn't it? A further evolution of a name from a person, where it only identifies the individual, to a family, as we saw when people use it properly or misproperly, to now being a family of nations or a land itself, people. So that's how names began to be important in our lives. When we look at a book called Ancient Greece, A Cultural Atlas for Young, it defines where many of the names of Javan's children actually migrated to. For example, when history shines its light upon Elisha, When history shines its light on a man by the name of Elisha, we find that he and his people trekked to the southwestern area of Greece. And in going down to that area of southwestern Greece, he set up shop there because he liked the soft, warm breezes, perhaps, but also because it was close to the water. And so we find that his people moved in that direction. We also found that Kittim's people migrated to the land of Cyprus. That's right here. So you have Greece, which is over here, and the southern part of Greece, where one of the family members migrated to, and you have the other one migrating to Cyprus. We find also that Rodanum and his people made their home on the shores of western Greece, right? So he made his shores right along here. That's where he made his home. And lastly, the Isle of Rhodes in the Rhone district in France both take their name from the scriptural Rhodanus. And so his people, they moved in along here in that area. And there are other of these same people that would move to Italy and all around Sardinia. All of these people made their homes in this area of the world. In contrast, Tarshish had his home originally over here on the southern end of Turkey. But he didn't stay there. He took what he could from that area. He certainly learned from the people that lived in the center of that area, which were called the Hittites. But eventually, he began to move out. And he was very much like what you would call the American pioneer. They would settle a certain area of land, but there was always that lure of the West, right? Always better and bigger lands farther west. And so he began to start to move outward this way. And everywhere he went, he began to set up little areas for rest stops. Later, these little areas of rest stops became colonies. And so you find right here an area where Carthage became known for a rest stop. And eventually became a very great trading center in its own right. He'd move into the areas up here where we have Venice. And over further, in this area here, which was called Tartessos in those days, we know today to be Cadiz. And all along the way, he was moving westward, until he crossed what we call, or what the ancients call, the Pillars of Hercules. That's right in here. What's that area called?
Gibraltar.
That's right, Gibraltar. And he passed through Gibraltar and into the Atlantic Ocean. Now, there were reasons for that. He didn't give up this area in here. He still continued his trade. But it appears that he continued through this area right in here. And he was always searching, ever looking, ever observing, finding that special pot of gold, so to speak. He was no homebody. So what was different about Tarshish as opposed to his brothers wasn't so much in the type of work they did, or in that respect, but in degrees, where they wouldn't have dreamed of moving away from their homelands in the distance. He did. That was part of his lifestyle. He was a frontiersman, in a sense. And so he moved ever so westward, undaunted by high seas and strong gales, uncharted coastlines, and refusing to subscribe to the superstitions of the day, Tarshish ships and crews traveled further and farther west than any sailor before him. As I said, well beyond the Hercules, or the Pillars of Hercules. To aid this adventurous voyages, Phoenician pilots put to use the astronomy they learned from the Babylonians. Indeed, the constellation containing the North Star, they refer to as Phoenici. By navigating using solar bodies and special landmarks, Tarshish and his descendants traversed the Mediterranean and beyond, always setting up colonies on the way. so that they would have a place to stop overnight. Over time, these staging areas became a place for trade. Gradually, they became colonies and trading areas in their own right and provided a thankful resting area for mariners on long voyages. Included, as I said, in these points were Venice, Malta, Cyprus, Carthage, Sicily, the Balearic Islands, which are right over here where Majorca is, and all of these became fashionable places from which they could meet other peoples and trade. Yes, they had taken risks, but they were calculated risks. And success often comes to the wildcatters of the days. They were that. To appreciate this homeland, we turn again to the scriptures and the prophetic books of both Isaiah and Jonah. Taking the prophet Isaiah first, he wrote around 725 B.C. From his writings concerning the Phoenician people, he talked about their success, and we're going to talk more about this in a minute, but he talked about the fact that they were on a sojourn. Now that's an important word. It is a term that denotes a great distance or a far off place. From the Hebrew, this tells us that it wasn't just an area that was close by, like the rest of their neighbors. It's a long way away. And so we have that statement. In Jonah 1, verse 3, we have these words recorded. And you all know the story of Jonah. But Jonah rose up to flee unto Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. And he went down to Joppa, and he found a ship going to Tarshish. So he paid the fare thereof, and went down into it, to go with him unto Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. Now the word that should be highlighted here, or right here, from the presence of the Lord. And that's important, because you got to go a long way to get away from the presence of the Lord. And that must have been in the thinking of this man at the time that occurred. He didn't want to do what God wanted him to do, and that was to preach to Assyria. Hopefully, he thought that if they turned and repented, then, you know, Assyria would continue to grow, right? And they would threaten northern Israel and his home. And he didn't want that. So he thought, well, if I just get far enough away, if I go in places where God does not dwell, I'll be safe. So that gives us some idea that Tarshish was a long way away. There's more. Let us turn our attention to the Chaldeans. And I looked up in the Bible, and you find out that from their language, the term Tarshish has actually two different but telling meanings. In addition, its definition, by definition, Tarshish means, in the Babylonian, the land of the stone. The land of the stone. Now that might not make a lot of sense until you realize that their land was famous for what they dug out of its rocks. And here we start to see an evolution in the name. First we saw it was a person, then it was identified with a family, then it was identified, we could see how it could be identified with a vast amount of people, and now it's identified with what they actually produced. Okay? And secondly, Tarshish is also defined by the Babylonians by what it was most legendary for, a merchant ship. So if you put those two together, you come up with something like this. With merchant ships, they traded their metals from their land, and that was what they were most famous for. So you see a merchant ship, and you see the metals of the land. Now let's push the clock forward, and we arrive at 900 to about 950 B.C. And if you read 1 Chronicles chapter 1:7, we're for sake of time, we won't, we are somewhat surprised to discover that they repeat the genealogy first found in Genesis. And that was a real mystery to me. I thought, well, why? It's a Hebrew book. It's about Hebrews. Why talk about these Gentiles. Why reiterate something we've already been shown? Well, the brother said it this morning in the first class. Anytime something is repeated, it's important. It's there for a reason. So let's be sure of this. Anytime something is doubled in the scriptures, it is because it holds a great deal of importance. These two books called the Chronicles were written with a purpose. They were committed to pen and ink after Israel's exile to Babylon. They were placed in print in order to aid Ezra's crusade to bring post-exile Judah back into conformity with the law of Moses. That was their purpose. These writings attempted to stress the importance of their past, what went right with Israel, and especially what went wrong. Zondervan, in his study, summarizes his reasons why both Jew and Gentile are represented in the opening pages of this book as follows. He said, "Doubtless these books served as a powerful incentive to the Jews who returned from exile to walk in the ways of the covenant of Sinai. To Christians, these books also serve as a reminder that no people will prosper unless collectively they walk in the ways of righteousness." Clearly, by finding Tarshish lineage here, we are reminded that the Almighty's reign is over all mankind, and not just Jews. When Gentiles, like the Jews, support the Almighty's effort, He never forgets. Quite to the contrary, God knows how to bless a people. Sometimes that blessing is through knowledge, sometimes that blessing is in terms of personal wealth, and sometimes it's both. At the time of the writing of this book, the man Tarshish had long since passed off his mortal coil, and his name was now associated with a place and with a people, as well as what they actually dug out of the earth. The fact that their genealogy is repeated again in the Chronicles reminds us that there still exists an important connection between both Jew and Gentile that will continue to remain ineradicably linked until the end of time. As for location, we discover from Herodotus' writings, and that's from 484 BC to about 432, that Tarshish was a land that was surrounded in secrecy. This Greek historian spoke of it often, frequently referring it to the Ten Islands, somewhere north of Europe, but always with a touch of cloak and dagger. I want to just read this to you from Herodotus. He said, I quote, "I have never found anyone who could give me first-hand information of a sea beyond Europe's north. Yet, it cannot be disputed that tin and amber do come to us from what one might call the ends of the earth." Again, there's that tie back to the original idea of a great distance far away. If you go to the Roman historian, Strabo, he brings us into Anno Domini. Now, the phrase he uses is that he says, basically, that it was concealed passage from everyone from the ends of the earth. Again, the idea of the ends of the earth. And it was, brothers and sisters, for a lot of people living in that time, the Mediterranean was where it was all happening. It was the center of the earth, so to speak. The place where Israel dwells is a land bridge of three great continents. People were very reluctant to get out of their security zones and go outward into the vast Atlantic. And we know that. We know that for ourselves, because when you start to see man thinking of finding a new way to China and India, and they start looking west instead of east, they're filled with all kinds of fears and superstitions and problems. Somehow, some way, Tarshish had overcome that fear. Somehow, they had pushed the envelope, and they were able to do what other seafaring people were not. The other thing is, to keep in mind, is that Tarshish was one of the best-kept secrets of her ancient days. Well, why not? Their people understood only too well that wealth can bring enemies to your doorstep. We've seen it over and over and over again. However, they equally recognized that a powerful nation never would commit their resources to hunting down a riddle. Right? And Tarshish, at this time, Tarshish was a riddle. On the other hand, being remote did not forbid Tarshish from carrying out their function and purpose as a great world trader. What set them head and shoulders above their fellow man was the distance they were willing to go to make a trade. Their willingness to travel where other men feared to tread had brought them to a land which contained a rare collection of the earth's most precious metals. But it took hard work and knowledge to remove those metals and then make them into pristine bars. Still, time moves on, and what the world really desired was a harder metal, one that could take punishment at every level. What they wanted was a metal that could hold up in case you needed it for services in fighting, in holding off your enemies. And at that time, they really didn't have one. Most of the metals were soft. For example, tin was too bendy and weak. Copper might be good for plumbing, but it left a lot to be desired in terms of hardness. And lead was just plain too heavy. So the world needed a harder, better metal that could take the punishment that would be meted out for all kinds of services, and especially military use. That's where Tarshish came into effect, really. They had all these metals right there. They had also been associated, as I said before, if you could show that map again, Matthew. They had also been associated with this area of the world here. What people came from that area of the world that were very instrumental in metal? Robert?
Hittites.
The Hittites are believed to be the first people that learned how to smelter metals and get them into their purest form. Well, they dwelt right down here. And you can bet that they traded things with the Hittites in order to understand that function. So now, they're over somewhere up here in the North Sea. The North Sea that Herodotus talked about. And they come to a land where they find all the metals they need. It's a rare thing to do. And they have the smeltering process. They understand it. And they begin, it appears, a period of experimentation. And they start putting certain metals together in their purest form to try to arrive at other certain metals that might be of value to them for the purpose they require. And they did. Sometimes later, using that same process, they experimented by mixing pure copper with pure tin. And what did they create? Anybody? Copper and tin makes what?
Bronze.
Exactly, bronze. And also, they mixed pure copper with pure zinc. What did they obtain?
Brass.
These are fairly hard metals, and you can use them. You can use them ornamentally, but you can use them physically for implements of war. And let me tell you, when you talk about nations in that world, all in this area, and you know the history of Israel alone, not to mention all these other great nations, the one thing that any government stood or fell on was their ability to protect their people, right? And chariots were made of iron, and you had to have swords, you had to have spears, and they needed metal tips, right? So when metal comes into being, Tarshish now suddenly becomes quite wealthy because they have it all right there. They have the key things to trade on the world markets that people want. They really do. And so we see this time as a time of great growth and prosperity for Tarshish. There's a problem, though. If Tarshish is, as some suggested, this area right here, we know today to be Britain. They're a long, long way from their other areas to trade with. It would be so nice if they could take all of their product and take it to one centralized location over here and trade with it there. They'd almost have 100% sales, right? They had exactly what they needed. At this time, it appears that the people up here began to move not only in this area, but also in this area, down the coast of Africa. They also appear to have moved up to this area, up here, up in the Scandinavian nations, all around Jutland and that area, France and northern Germany. So they had access to a great deal more to trade with than anybody on the face of this earth. Now I want to now turn to, we've started here the Bronze Age, and you could see how that would be very significant. I want to again look at Tarshish location. I want you to consider Wales. Now, where is Wales? Well, this area right in here is what we call Wales. That's the lizard, they call it right there on the western end. This was an area that was beyond the Pillars of Hercules in somewhat remote location, but yet not too far away as to keep it from trading with the Middle Sea area. Secondly, by having discovered within her buried rock formations the best collection of metals in the then known world, she came to the marketplaces and her colonies with something of great value to trade. Thirdly, by having access to large stands of oak and yew, right from here, which is around London, all the way over, in those early days, huge stands of oak and yew. What would that be good for if you were a seafaring people?
Shipbuilding,
exactly. So they had all the resources they need. They had the metals, they had the wood, and they had the boats to carry it to other places. And by trading what they had for what other people had, they now had something else to trade to other people, and so on, and so on, and so on. And so they became a very vast, great trading nation. And that was their strength, brothers and sisters. It wasn't like so many of these armies over here where you find in Mesopotamia where there were powerful agricultural countries. Their power resided in their ability to trade, in merchandising, in all of the stages of warehousing. That's where they made their money, and that's where they were able to trade with other great nations. So you see that. There's a writer by the name of Sarah Aronson, and she wrote a book called The Encircled Sea. And she said, Tarshish means smelter in Phoenician, and the many places called by this name, Tarsus, Tartosa, and the like, point to the extent of that activity. The best known copper mines in the then known world were in Cyprus and Spain. The source of tin is still controversial. Phoenician colonies like Cadiz, which was down at the very southern end of Spain, beyond the Straits of Gibraltar, pointed to Cornwall, England, which is indeed the only major source of tin within maritime reach of the Mediterranean region. And the Phoenicians, she said, kept this route, a tin route, a grave secret. Note the word grave. They didn't want people to know where their stuff was. They didn't want people to know that they had all this wealth in that land there. It was an invitation to conquer, right? They didn't want that to be known. It was great that they were in a land that was misted over half the time and in a land of mystery. People didn't know where they were, and they wanted to keep it that way. As far as they were concerned, they wanted people to think that all their great vast wealth came from that inner middle sea. And they just traded from one to another to another. And that way, people didn't catch on. But they had a vast source of wealth there on the south of Wales. It was that profusion of lead and zinc and tin and later iron that made them so very, very famous. Now, there were other places that had these things. For example, Afghanistan has a collection of the same metals. Also, there are places, let me see, Turkey has those areas in its deep center part. It has those. But both of these have problems in being the ancient Tarshish. And the reason they have problems is because Turkey, where they have it, is way up on the Anatolian plain. It's too high. It's too difficult to get that down to the sea coast in the vast amount of array numbers that they would require. Afghanistan is completely landlocked and very, very primitive. So the only real location that I would suggest is the island of Great Britain, Tarsus. Yeah.
You mean the Anatolian plateau?
Yeah, did I say plain? Yeah, plateau, excuse me. Okay. There's something else, brothers and sisters, we need to understand. Something else became as valuable as all her metals, concluding together. And that had to do with a wonderful purple dye. Now, why would purple be important in those days? What do you think might be significant?
Color of royalty.
Color of royalty. Yeah. And it was a beautiful, beautiful dye, and it was worth its weight in gold. Now, they found this first in a particular mollusk called
Murex.
Yes. The murex, right. In that murex, they had a process for extracting this wonderful dye, and then they would sell it to the various different governments throughout the world. And they made a lot of money on that. Well, interestingly enough, they found the murex mollusk in vast array just south in an area around Wales. And they were able to take advantage of that as well. So you could see that all that area seems to point to where Tarshish location actually was. It had all the things that you'd ever want in a nation, right? It was hidden away. It had wealth in metals. It had wealth in dyes. It had everything you needed. And it had great stands of wood so that you could take that, put it into building boats, and send it to the corners of the earth. And already, they were going all around the world. It is suggested that they actually traversed around the Cape of Storms, right down here, going up. And these lines show some of the places that they probably would have gone. So by going around here, they now came to places, exotic places like Madagascar and India. And what would they have received from those areas? Well, there were silks, there was mullins, there were gems, there was teak wood, there was all kinds of precious silks, and especially all kinds of tea and herbals and condiments. All of that came from this area of the world. And so by bringing all that back to this area, they had that as well to accumulate, which other nations didn't have, right? So you can see how they could become very, very wealthy very, very quickly. Well, let's move on. Last, we come to the most important part of what made the ships of Tarshish famous. And it has to do with her ties to who? Anybody know?
Solomon
is one of them, but that's only one phase. What's the other big city?
Tyre,
right. Where is Tyre located?
North.
Right about there. Notice, there, you can go up from here all around to Europe, or you can go up from here into Asia. You can go down into Africa. And a brother mentioned Israel, and that's an important part right there too, because they got to know Israel very well. And if you take that route south through here, through the Gulf of Aden, you cut off thousands of miles to get to India. And you can bring it right up through the trade routes right into the city itself. Fascinating. all the wealth of the world was coming to this people here, and they were bringing it to this people here at Tyre. They were all Phoenicians. And that's important. That's an important evolution, because most nations went off on their own. Most people went off on their own. They struck out on their own. But Tarshish, or the people of Tarshish, recognized the importance of their ability to trade when it was combined with their ability to sell. But they didn't do the selling. Tyre did the selling. Tyre had the short sea coast. All along that area, they set up warehousing, and ships could come right in there, and they could unload their goods and then bring them into the great city itself with all its tents and booths and stores. And people from all over the world would come to that city, and they would be dazzled by the color and the smells and the exoticness of all that they saw. And they would buy in this area right here. It became what you call the mart of the nations. In fact, if I had to give it a name at this time, you might call it the Walmart of the nations at that time. Literally. Okay? So this was a win-win situation all around, right? A combination of the two made for success built upon success. Yes, sir?
Going to mention that passage in 1 Kings 9, the deal that...
I'm getting there. No, no, if you want to read it now, let me see if I've got it right here.
I just thought it was a perfect verse.
Why don't you read it now? I've got 1 Kings 10 something, but you go ahead.
Yeah, it's in 1 Kings 9, it says, King Solomon built a fleet of ships at Ezion Geber, which is near Elah, on the shore of the Red Sea in the land of Edom. And Hiram, that's from the, right, the Tyre, sent with the fleet his servants, seamen, who were familiar with the sea, together with the servants of Solomon, and they went to Ophir and brought their gold to the Mount of etc., etc., to King Solomon. So there's your buyer, a supporter, he's with the Tyrians, and the point about the seamen got together. So all of these things you've been talking about, you find in one verse, because Solomon knew what it was like to do a trade.
That's right. So we have that. I was going to say that about it being a Walmart and everything, but we're getting to another very important point, and our brother brought it up, and that is Hiram, who was the leader of this beautiful system, came to know and understand a man that he admired greatly. And who was that man?
Solomon.
And before him?
David.
David. David was the man that he got to know. And I believe, brothers and sisters, he got very, very familiar with his writings. Okay? Very familiar with his writing. And there was the key word that I think that we have to use here is the word love. Hiram loved David. And as a consequence, when the time came to build the house of the Lord, what did he do? Well, he lent his craftsmen, his workers, and his navy to Solomon. And that's where they built a new navy, right in that area that our brother was speaking of, so that they could go east as well as west. And they brought all the valuable things of the world to that great temple area. And Solomon became known. I mean, if you're going to be the wisest man in the world, you got to look the part, right? And Solomon looked the part. And it was a wonderful, wonderful thing, because of all the things that he did for Solomon to help him build that temple from wood to his craftsmen. It eventually was a terrific success. It became one of the great temples in the world at that time. So as a result of that, Solomon was able to draw all kinds of people, all kinds of nations, all kinds of leaders to his land to hear his wisdom. And they brought gifts. That's why Solomon became very, very wealthy. It wasn't a matter of just trading, exactly. It was that. But it was more than that. Great gifts were brought to Solomon just to hear his wisdom. And it expanded out. And one of the nations, obviously, that was there to hear it was Hiram. However, time moves on. And we also understand, we've only got a couple minutes here, that as time went on, as we see so often in people and in nations, that things began to change, right? Solomon turned out to have his problems with women. Hiram had his troubles with the god what? What god was there that they worship in Sidonia? Well, no. Bigger one. It's a weather god. Weather god Baal. And so as Baal began to increase in popularity, people turned away from the teachings of David. Surely in that area. We're not told a lot about it. We have to kind of connect the dots. But in Solomon's time, the same problem. They were worshiping up high in the groves, the Astaroths and all those things. And eventually, his people were turned away. And over time, it eventually led to the point where God had to punish them. And around 606 BC, the Babylonian army came down from this area up here and it defeated both nations and it carried both peoples away. For 70 years they were carried away. And when they returned, you would have thought that they would have learned something about this. But they didn't learn anything about it. Instead, they thought that their biggest problem and the reason why they were conquered here on the mainland was because they were on the mainland. So they went a few miles out to sea and they built on an island the same type of city that they had before. Only this time, they really pushed immorality, sex, whoredom, all that stuff became part of the selling process. And God looked at these terrible things and these terrible events that were happening, and he was very, very disappointed. And eventually, I've tried to condense this for the sake of time, he writes these words through the prophet of Ezekiel, chapter 26 through 28, and I've condensed them in this respect. "Hast thou been in Eden, the garden of God, when I made it?" He's talking here to the people of Phoenicia. "Why then do you now see yourself as a great creator in your own right? Is this reason based on your talents, the shipbuilding, the trade routes, the colonies, the mining, the smelting, the warehousing, the banking, the selling, and all the other commercial ventures that pertain to it? Because you have let slip the true knowledge of the one who first helped you, blessed you, and drew you forth, not because of any special merits on your part, but because you aided my greater objective in Jerusalem when building my temple, I blessed you with knowledge and wisdom, just as with Solomon. I alone have elevated you over your peers. So why now do you say in your heart, 'I am a god, I sit in the seat of God in the midst of the seas'? Because of your pride, I say back calmly to you, Tyre, thou art only a man, though you set your heart to the heavens. Therefore, because you have not kept your first estate and chose instead to dignify yourself and not me, I, the Lord, will bring you down to the grave. I will make you like the top of the rocks. Thus shall Tyre be a place to spread nets upon, and thou shalt be built no more. For I, the Lord, have spoken it." And that's exactly what happened. What happened about 200 years later is a man by the name of Alexander the Great came to those shores and he looked at the situation and he saw Tyre sitting out on an island there in this impregnable fortress. And instead of giving up and turning away, he said, he looked to the east and he saw this huge pile of rubble. And what was that huge pile of rubble from? Well, it was from the time when what? Yeah, the old city. They didn't remove it. They just left it there. And so he took his generals aside and he said, "Boys, I want you to move that mass to the water's edge because there we're going to sort through it and we're going to build us a nice little causeway right out to the city." Now I want you to think of it because if you missed this, you missed a lot. He was taking, in effect, their old sins and creeping it out right to the city's gate. The old sins were merging with the new sins to bring down the destruction of the great city of Tyre. And that's exactly what happened. And some of the people did escape out of the western end of the city as his troops were coming over the walls to breach it. And Tyre, in effect, became no more. except in one very important thing I have to mention before we go. God saw that in his great plan and purpose, that a Gentile people had been helpful to his people. And that help that they gave him helped prosper Solomon for a period of time. And God saw that if it happened before, why not use it again in the future? And so that big shadow that Tyre and Tarshish had once had now became pushed into the future. And tomorrow we want to pick up and see how that shadow becomes a reality. We want to start seeing the emerging events that brings this people who will be have been dead for nearly 1,800 years back into life. I'll see you tomorrow.